They all seem to be on the other team.
Yeah, well, yeah,
I have no idea. All I know is
four, five.
Open the House Committee on Health Care. Come to order for February 24th for what should be an interesting meeting. We'll start with a work session for the only purpose of introducing committee measures. Remember when we voted on bills to be introduced as committee measures, we're not voting on the whether we support or oppose that bill, we're just putting it in the process.
Are you sure?
Mr. Vice Chair, can I have a...
Yes, Mr. Chair. Please? All right, I'd like to move the following LCs and be introduced as committee bills, Mr. Chair. LC 1424, dated January 30, 2017. LC 2615, dated November 9, 2016. LC 2807, dated November 15, 2016. LC 3514, dated February 22, 2017. LC 3897, dated February 17, 2017. LC 4004, dated February 15, 2017, and for good measure, let's throw in LC 4049, dated February 9th, 2017.
Representative Notes moves the adoption of a list of LCs as so specified as committee bills. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Yes.
I know we do these as committee bills, but one of those, LC 4049, refers to the hospital assessment or the provider tax, which was put together by a bipartisan group with a commitment for about 4 years going forward. So I would be opposed to running that through here without engaging with the group that set up that hospital assessment.
Is there any other discussion?
I too object to LC 4049.
Pardon me?
I too have issue with LC 4049.
So can we have a roll call?
Yeah, well, I wonder if we need a roll call the whole list as well. Please call the roll.
Representative Penny Geyer.
Proudly aye.
Representative Mueller.
Proudly no.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
Excuse.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
No.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
No.
Chair Freeland.
Aye. The motion carried. The bills are on their way to be introduced.
I didn't call you.
And I will close the work session and open an informational hearing. The purpose of the hearing today, which we hope should be interesting, is to look at the drivers of health care costs. We're going to have several bills, I expect, including the one that was in controversy a minute ago, dealing with how we rein in costs in the healthcare system. I thought it would be useful for us to get some shared understanding of what the cost drivers are. So we'll see if we can get that understanding today. We're going to start by calling folks from the Oregon Health Authority. Will you join us? Folks who actually give us some information and somebody to press a button. That's good.
Yes.
Yeah. Please start. Introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, Representative Greenlick. I'm Mark Fairbanks. I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. Please, my colleagues will introduce themselves as well.
Good morning, Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning, Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics.
If you start talking again, reintroduce yourself, please.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So I'm Mark Fairbanks, CFO for the Oregon Health Authority, and we're going to talk today, as you just mentioned, Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, the cost drivers, an overview of cost drivers as they relate to our Medicaid model for delivering care. We really want to focus on, this is a high-level presentation as requested, And we're going to cover pharmaceutical costs as a driver. We're going to cover new treatment and expanded benefits on the Oregon Health Plan. And we'll be speaking about provider reimbursement in general, or what I would call as the direct costs of medical care that are delivered by the CCOs. I'd like to point out that a little-known fact that we operate our program on a sustainability threshold of 3.4%. So that is a driving light for us as we move forward in the hard work of transforming care and improving quality of care while reducing the per capita cost. On the next slide, you'll find reports that will provide details, and we recommend these to you to support this overview as some of the pertinent details to really explain and inform. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Rickards to cover pharmacy costs.
All right. Good morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden. I'm Jim Rickards, Oregon Health Authority Chief Medical Officer. When we look at some of the drivers that are increasing health care costs for the Oregon Health Authority, one of these is pharmaceutical costs. This is a function of both increased volume or number.
Can we dim the lights a little?
Go ahead. No problem. So the increased pharmaceutical costs are both a function of increased volume or number of prescriptions written, as well as an increased price for the drugs that we're paying for. We look at that first graphic. We can see that when it comes to the volume of drugs, they're increasing from 2014 to 2015. The volume increased by about 12%. The good news about this slide is that the majority of the drugs that we're providing for are generics. That's largely a function of the fact that they're prioritized on our preferred drug list. We have a preferred drug list that prioritizes drugs based on the safety, effectiveness, and cost of drugs. So when we look at that graphic there, we see that while the volume of drugs is going up, it's mainly the generic drugs which are increasing. However, when we move over to the next graphic, we see that when it comes to expenditures on drugs, the story is a little bit different. About two-thirds of our drug expenditures are for brand-name drugs, which is interesting because if you look and see that only about 10 to 15% of the drugs that are prescribed for are brand names. The majority of the costs are for brand name drugs. And that's largely because the cost of the individual drugs themselves are quite high. That graphic is showing the total or gross expenditures. That was about a 20% increase in gross expenditures from 2014 to 2015. This gets a little bit into the complexity of how we purchase drugs for Medicaid. We displayed gross expenditures here. However, what we also have to focus on are the net costs or what we actually wound up paying in the end. And that's because drugs are priced, but then we receive a rebate on the drugs. And for Medicaid, there's actually two types of rebates we receive. One is a standard rebate under the Medicaid drug rebate program, and there's actually three different percentages of rebates. For brand name drugs in general, it's about a 23% rebate. And then we also receive supplemental rebates. So then if we, and we don't have it displayed here, but the net cost increase from 2014 to 2015 was about 10% for all drugs. So then if we put that in the context of all of healthcare spending, that's what the bottom graph shows there. We see that if the drug spend is increasing at 10%, but if our goal is to keep costs at under 3.4%, if we have one piece of the healthcare pie that's growing at a faster rate than the others, then it's going to take up a larger and larger percentage of over healthcare spending. And that's what we see there in 2013, about 15.9% of our expenditures were on pharmaceuticals. And then in 2015, we had nearly 16% of our expenditures on pharmaceuticals. So as we spend more and more on pharmacy, we're challenged then to keep under that 3.4% when it comes to spending on other things like behavioral health, dental, et cetera. The next slide then dives a little bit deeper into this. We show that per capita spending for generic, brand, and specialty drugs is increasing. For generic drugs, it's about a 7 to 9% increase. That increase is coming largely about because of that increased volume of prescription drugs, but there's also some increased prices of the drugs. And then for the brand and specialty drugs, remember I noted that the volume or the number of prescriptions was staying the same, so this per capita increase is really a function of the price. So the price of these drugs is increasing, but when these new drugs come to market, they're coming to market at higher and higher prices than ever before. The other side of the slide shows one of these specialty drugs in particular, hepatitis C drugs. These are direct-acting antiviral drugs. This is a new class of medications which hit the market in 2013. It was really a revolutionary class of drugs used to treat hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a viral infection that affects the liver mainly. There's five stages of disease, 0 through 4. And we can see there in that slide that up through August of 2016, our gross expenditures for just treating hepatitis C with one class of drugs, the DAAs, is about $82.5 million. So then the question becomes, well, I'm sorry, is there a question?
Mr. Chair, you got a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Are we going to later also see what the savings would be as a result of that, people not developing complications from hepatitis C somewhere in here?
Yeah, I don't have that displayed in here. That is an interesting question, though, because then the question is, well, who do those savings accrue to? Because you have older individuals that were age into Medicare. Hepatitis C, it's a chronic disease. Sometimes people can live 15, 20, 30 years. So then the question becomes, what do those savings accrue to Medicare, perhaps a commercial insurer if the person leaves the Oregon Health Plan? We didn't display that here. We're just focusing on the costs.
No, just a quick question.
And why wouldn't you? I mean, if you're really going to do a thorough cost-benefit analysis of the drivers of healthcare, why wouldn't you look at the long-term savings?
We could certainly bring that back. Studies show that on average, an individual with hepatitis C, the lifetime costs range anywhere from $90,000 to $120,000 for the total treatment. So you could use that as a rough estimate for individual savings. Yeah. But we didn't display it in this, but we can get that for you. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Part of the problem is, Representative Bueller and Representative Kennegeier, is that it's hard for actuaries to account for a 20-year potential save. That's what they tell me when we talk about this. It's not easy to build that into your rate when you have to build a rate for the next year or the year after. The cost shows up, you have to account for it. It's a claim.
Actually, on a cost-benefit analysis, the easiest way would be to let them die. That's a lot cheaper than I don't think we want to take that approach. But.
Yeah, and we're trying just to show the cost drivers here with this presentation. Then the question becomes, well, is there anything you're doing to help control these costs around pharmacy? One thing I'm often asked is, why don't you partner with other states and negotiate better drug prices? We do that. Drug purchasing, it's very complex. You don't actually negotiate the price on the front end, but you typically negotiate a better rebate on the back end. So for Medicaid, we receive standard drug rebates, but then we also negotiate what are called supplemental drug rebates. As more competitors come to market, then the supplemental rebates you're offered are better because the competitors want to have their drugs preferentially placed on the preferred drug list. We currently work with what's called the Sovereign State Drug Consortium. It's a pool of 12 states and nearly 5 million lives to negotiate the best supplemental rebates possible for Oregonians. We also have the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. This is a program that's part of what's called the Northwest Drug Consortium, so we can actually work with Washington State to negotiate better drug prices. Currently, only one of our CCOs is part of that. That generates savings mainly by getting lower ingredient costs, but then also savings on administrative fees. So between that Sovereign State Drug Consortium and the OPDP program, those are the two things we're doing to try to address pharmaceutical costs. But really, price is the problem. These drugs can be brought to market at really any price the market will bear, and often when there's no competitors, there's not much of a market.
So, another question. Yeah.
Quick question there, Mr. Chair. Can you estimate how much you've saved by participating in both of those coalitions?
Yeah, so that's a good question. OPDP savings, what we've seen, about a 10 to 14% savings on the ingredient costs and the admin fees. The supplemental rebates, you know, that's interesting. Those are proprietary. We're not allowed to actually share those. When the state P&T committee reviews the supplemental rebates, it goes in the executive session, and those are all, confidential. However, I can say that over the 3 to 4 years that hepatitis C drugs have been on the market, initially we were paying around $81,000 to $85,000 net costs. Now we're paying about $36,000. $1 billion for net costs, and that's largely a function of there being more drugs in the market, so more competition, and then better supplemental rebates. So we've seen that price come down, you know, by greater than half over time.
I think it's very interesting that I think the issue that Representative Bueller was raised talks about value-based pricing, which is, by definition, all the market will bear. When Cefalic came in, the fact is it's $84,000 a better deal than the cost of treatment over time. Yeah, it is, but is it still the right price? Or should the price be based on other factors? The fact that they're selling it to us now at $35,000 and making money on it, I'm sure, I haven't heard any of those drug companies going bankrupt yet, indicates the how arbitrary and capricious the price was to begin with.
Yeah.
Let's keep going.
Yeah. All right. So next slide. So it's not just pharmaceutical costs that are or pharmacy costs that are driving increased costs for the Oregon Health Authority. We also have some expanded and new benefits available. We don't have as a detailed financial analysis of these, as they're mostly new. But some of these include applied behavioral analysis or ABA services for autism treatment. This came about as a result of Senate Bill 365. This was some legislation that mandated that commercial insurers cover ABA services, but also directed the HERC of the OHA to look at ABA services. The HERC found good evidence for providing these services. We started providing services in 2015 under a fee-for-service carve-out starting July 1 of 2016. CCOs took over responsibility and financial risk for managing ABA services. Currently, though, they're administered through what's called a risk corridor for an 18-month period. So at the end of that 18-month period that began July 1, we'll do a reconciliation with the CCOs and then also get a better idea on what the costs are associated with this benefit. Treatment of back pain, this is also something new for the Oregon Health Authority. In 2013, we had about 50,000 Medicaid members who suffered from back pain. Around 30,000 of them received opioids to treat that. It was largely because there weren't really any other options available. The HERC looked into the benefits. They found strong evidence for supporting payment of services such as acupuncture, yoga, physical therapy, occupational therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. July 1 of 2016, that benefit, or those expanded benefits went live, and we'll be monitoring them to see what type of utilization and costs are associated with that. Hep C, this was similar to the previous discussion on pharmacy costs, but we're looking to expand treatment to all of stage 2 disease for hepatitis C. We've put in a policy option package asking for $32 million of general fund dollars to treat an estimated 3,300 Oregonians with stage 2 hepatitis C. So this could be a large expansion of benefits if approved. And then finally, expansion of adult dental services for non-pregnant women. This is a result of some legislative action, which restored benefits to what were previously in place in 2003-2009. So this provided for expanded preventative services along with other things such as prosthodontics and periodontal services. So those are just some of the expanded benefits, which are also driving costs to some extent.
Thank you. I just wanted you to repeat because I think I heard it wrong. I thought you said 15,000 were experiencing back pain. And of those, 30,000 went on opioids. So I must have heard the first.
Sorry, 50,000, 50,000 in 2013, Medicaid members were diagnosed with back pain, and 30,000 received opioids. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Terrific. So moving on, we're going to a couple of comments about the CCO financial status. So you'll find on slide 8 that a quick picture of operating margins and total margins. You will note that I think the advent of the ACA in 2014, when we've been widely discussing it with you and others for a while now, and you can see that the advent of the ACA had a fairly marked impact with the number of people entering the system and the rates that were developed based on a lack of a lot of trending and actuarially, what we would call actuarial sound data back in the day. And since that time, we have redeveloped our model. It is a actuarial sound model consistently applied. It really focuses on population risk across the state and within the regions and within the CCOs and matches that risk to rate. You'll see that I think the couple things about this is the stabilization that's occurring as rates have been developed more specifically to the cost of care and the risk associated with that population. You see a narrowing of the margins, which I think would be expected. It does put an exclamation point on, and we work with our CCOs constantly on this, the direct cost of medical care. We've highlighted some specific, you know, pressure points with new drugs, with pharmacy costs, but I'm talking about the cost of delivering care in general. And the cost trends that the CCOs are facing or experiencing, I should say, and our constant effort to innovate, this is where the war will be won at the provider level. It's at what our CCOs are paying for services. And it's going to require, that's where the innovation and the transformation has to occur to really make this work in the long term. So the rates are stabilizing. They're within national benchmarks, they're right in line. And so I'll move to the next slide, which talks about net assets. This is going to be the current requirement in the contracts for CCOs to maintain a 5% net asset level of average revenue as a minimum amount of operating capital. Now, one of the issues I think that are, or one of the questions that was sent to us, Representative Greenlick, before this meeting was, you know, some comments on the sensitivity of that number is, and what that number, this is what it is, what should it be. We believe, and as always was the intention of the program, for those of you who preceded me, that we would move closer to a 10% marker for minimum amount of operating capital. That is in line with NAIC in commercial insurance thresholds used by DCBS. You'll notice that in the graph, and I also say that, again, the details.
Total assets now are about $200 million. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
The total reserves at the moment are around $200 million.
Yes, in certain cases. If you look down this chart, you'll find some CCOs will have.
No, I'm talking about the total asset and CCOs, I think, are just about $200 million.
Yes. Yes, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. So this is the this chart. Actually, it's just but one half of one chart that is included in this report. This is one of the links you have in our deck. This is the latest legislative report on CCO performance across the board. So there's a. I would recommend this to you because there's quite a bit of detail here. So the little white line you'll see in the 2016 dark blue bar along the left right hand side of the chart will show you where the 5% marker is for each of the CCOs. It gives an idea of order of magnitude of what is the minimum requirement and then what would be what we would consider excess operating reserve.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Two questions. One, going back before, I believe from our Ways and Means, it's been presented to us that the inflationary rate for the health plan part of the budget, I think it's 4.1% versus the 3.4% that we always brag about being able to complete. If you could address that. And a follow-up question on the 5% of the minimum amount that is reserved that most of our CCOs require, a few of them have kind of a little different calculation. You mentioned that you're wanting to move that or proposing to move that to 10%. So are we encouraging that increase and in having CCOs hold amounts above the minimum without restrictions on what they do with that, or how is that transition taking place?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, to the second question, no, we haven't. I have not been, and we have not been engaged in a discussion around other limitations on the amount of reserves that we would expect. I think the focus is on what is the industry standard for health plans to ensure the right amount of risk-based capital, the right amount, or a safe amount, I guess I would say, for operating reserves that you would see in the industry. And this is an amount that then would require a CCO to have a certain amount of efficiency and profitability and save to handle risk.
So follow up on.
Well, let's go to the first question.
Okay. And then I'm sorry, could you restate the first question for me?
The inflationary rate in the budget for the Oregon Health Authority, I believe it. My computer's glitching, so I couldn't find it, but I believe it was 4.1 inflationary rate versus the 3.4 that we always you know, pride ourselves in being able to accomplish. What is not included in the, why do we have to use a 4.1 inflationary rate versus a 3.4 if that's the true cost?
Total OHA budget increase?
Well, we operate the entire OHP budget in the aggregate on an annual basis within the 3.4 as our commitment to CMS. It's inside of our 1115 waiver to secure funding with from the federal government. I think you're putting your finger right on the stress point on the cost trends. We need to figure out with our model, our operating model, how to stay within the 3.4 in spite of national indicators that would be higher.
Please go on. We're running.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Leslie Clement now on talk a little bit about hospital status.
Okay, good morning. For the record, Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. I'm going to review briefly the hospital financial report. As Mark previously mentioned, there are three links in your presentation. One is to the acute care hospital financial and utilization trend point. The other is a community benefit report. And then there is also the Oregon Hospital Payment Report, but I'll mostly focus on the first two reports. So OHA contracts with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems to obtain data that informs this presentation. The data originates from the Data Bank, a vendor product out of Colorado that maintains data for 14 different states. It includes 26 of Oregon's 28 DRG hospitals. The Kaiser facilities do not report hospital-level financial data. There's a statute that's referred to the Kaiser rule that exempts them from that. This slide reflects changes since 2011 through 2015 in hospital operating revenue and in uncompensated care. On the left, you'll see that from 2011 to 2013, operating revenue increased by 8.5%. However, from 2013 to 2015, operating revenue increased by 17%, doubling the rate of growth since the pre-ACA period. The chart on the right shows that since ACA, uncompensated care has fallen 65%.
Very interesting.
This slide shows additional trends. The chart on the left represents total margin as a percent of total revenue. The total revenue includes money earned from non-hospital services such as investment income and tax subsidies. In 2015, the 26 DRG hospitals for which there was financial data retained 8.9% of their total revenue in profit. The chart on the right represents the total amount of money this margin represents for the DRG hospitals. The 26 hospitals had a combined total of $857 million in profit in 2015. I'm going to turn now to the topic of hospital community benefits. There are 11 categories of hospital benefits that include unreimbursed Medicare and Medicaid costs. This is often referred to as underpayment. There's health professional education included, charity care, research, community health improvement, other public programs, subsidized health services, cash and in-kind contributions, community building, and community benefit operations, really administration. And the definitions for these different services are included in the community benefit report. The chart on the left represents year-over-year change in total community benefit costs. Community benefit costs have remained relatively flat since the ACA began, growing by a little under 1% from 2014 to 2015. The chart on the right represents the proportion that unreimbursed costs of Medicare and Medicaid contribute to the total community benefit costs. Since 2011, unreimbursed costs of these two programs have become a larger percentage of community benefit, growing from 53% in 2011 to 70% in 2015. State statute allows hospitals to claim Medicare unreimbursed costs as a community benefit. However, Medicare is not allowed to be reported as a community benefit under the federal tax code.
I'm trying to understand that last benefit report, and maybe I'm just reading it wrong.
So as ACA has covered more people,
yep.
The charity care that goes to covering people without insurance has dropped dramatically.
That's right.
And yet, so that's why I don't understand, why has the red portion, unreimbursed costs, grown? Is it this is underpayment by Medicaid and Medicare?
Chair Greenlech, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. It represents both the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement levels are lower.
So it's the gap.
So it's that, yes.
So, okay.
Yep.
Thank you. I got that.
Okay. Next slide.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nose.
But in spite of that, if you go back to the previous slides, it doesn't seem to be... doesn't seem to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
That's correct.
Full amount versus percentage.
The under reimbursed costs.
Like the
juxtaposition of that.
The bottom line.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's
right. That's
I mean.
Right. This is a mythical amount in this state rather than a real amount. There's a lot of myth in this whole area. Interesting man.
Okay, I'm going to proceed ahead to the final slide. The chart on the left shows the year-over-year change in charity care costs. Charity care, as we've discussed, has fallen substantially in the 2 years since ACA began. Total charity care costs were $382 million in 2013, but had dropped to $157 million in 2015. And between 2013 and 2014, charity care fell 35%, and between 14 and 15, charity care fell another 36%. The graph on the right side shows the proportion of the total community benefit costs that can be characterized as direct contributions into the surrounding community. Together, community health, cash, and in-kind contributions and community building costs comprise about 4% of the total community benefit costs. So that concludes my portion.
A very small percentage of the total hospital revenue.
Chair Greenlech, that's correct.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there any final questions of this panel? We'll have more stuff.
Yeah.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chair Greenlech. A few questions, actually. Do we have a target net profit margin for CCOs?
Chair Greenlech, or Representative Mueller, no, we do not. We do not have a target set for margins, is your question correct?
Okay.
What we are obviously, what we're doing here is we're watching the sustainability of each of our model, each of our 16 CCOs in terms of the operating platform, its sustainability, its profitability, its cash flow, but we do not dictate margins.
Another question?
Go ahead.
In the slide that you had net assets for the CCOs, what year is that referenced? Is that
Chair Greenlech, like Representative 16. Bueller?
That's not net assets, that's reserves, right?
They labeled it as
both. I think you're referring to slide 9, and it's the section, it's the graphic on the right side of that slide. And the gray bar, 2014, then 15, then 16. 16 is 6 months.
Okay, thank you. And one more question, please.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if any of you have read this report that came out from, the Center for Public Service, Portland State University last week, entitled Oregon's Looming Employer Cost Compensation Challenge.
I have not seen the report. I'm sorry, Representative Greenlech, Representative Mueller, I have not seen that report.
I'm just wondering, since they're projecting at least a 30% increase in public employee total compensation over the next 5 years, that's not included in your cost drivers.
You are correct. We did not include that in this list. But certainly the overall medical trend is going to be that's going to be a variable. It's going to be a function of increasing medical trend would be the increase of it, and in this case, in this case, it would be the employee cost, the cost of delivering the services within the CCO model? Or are you referring to public employees in general?
All of the above.
Yeah.
It also is increasing.
Yeah, but that's an excellent point. And
I can assure you, having joined the PEB board recently, that the PEB benefits are not going to go up above 3.4%.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
That's for sure. Because that's all the money they're going to have.
Yeah.
So that gets them into some price discussions, because then the issue is what's happening with the price increase in hospitals and other places. Are they really justified by it? It's going to have to be a different set of negotiations.
That's for sure.
Yes.
Quick question.
And let's getting call to, the next panel while
getting to that cost driver. What percentage of your employees are public sector employees in hospitals, basically? I mean, I'm sure you can't come up with an exact, but just approximately.
Representative Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, I'm sorry, I can't speak to that level of detail. I have to get back to you on that one. Okay.
What's the question?
Be able to get that.
Yeah. The question, and I'm building on what I think you were getting at, the cost of public employees because of the PERS liability is projected to grow up to 30%. I'm assuming that's what you got to, and I just wondered what percentage of hospital employees, if we're talking about hospital employees here.
What proportion of hospital employees
are public employees?
They have thousands.
So I'm just wondering what percentage.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I believe Bay Area is a public sector hospital in Coos Bay. OHSU is kind of, because it's a public corporation, so it participates in PERS. And there might be a few other super small, like like in Klamath Falls and that area of the world. But most of them are private nonprofits, not government entities. There's 60 hospitals.
But OHA has thousands of public employees. I'm just not talking, which is included in their administrative costs of running.
My understanding that, Mark, you may have a number on this, that the employee costs of is roughly 3% of the OHA budget or something like that?
That is correct, Representative Chair Greenlick.
A lot of people, but
there's another issue.
I mean, we could cut that out entirely and we still have a pretty big OHA budget.
But there's other effects of who delivers this care. With we're driving up the cost of, you know, with minimum wage, with paid time off. I mean, there's all kinds of cost drivers associated with employment costs. I mean, 85% of the budget is labor cost.
3% of the OHA budget is labor cost.
Not when they're paying for a bunch of labor, right? Well over 80% of health care is labor cost.
I don't remember that. Now, you're talking about healthcare generally, not the OHA budget.
Yeah.
I think the point is we could eliminate all employees from the OHA budget, and the budget would, you wouldn't notice a decrease. Can we? Thank you very much,
thank
guys.
Thank you.
This isn't
I appreciate that. Professor McConnell, will you join us now, please? In way of introduction, Professor McConnell is a professor at OHSU and has been very helpful to the state for a long time, providing a semi-objective source of data. He's an economist, so it's not entirely.
Okay, that's fair. All right, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nasi, Vice Chair Hayden, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is John McConnell. I'm from Oregon. Health and Science University. I represent the Center for Health Systems Effectiveness, and I guess I should say I'm speaking as a researcher, not as a sort of a spokesperson for OHSU here.
We've asked you to do, and I appreciate it.
So I'm going to cover three things. I'm going to kind of go a little bit bigger picture, perhaps, than the last presentation, and talk about the economist view on what's making healthcare costs go up. Talk a little bit about what's happening in Oregon, and then maybe outline just a slide or two on policy options. I'll talk about three drivers for healthcare spending. I think an important one that often forgets but's front and center for economists is technology. And technology and technological advances is a broad term that includes a lot of the things that you heard about in the last presentation, such as new drugs, new treatments, new tests, new procedures. I've got a slide here of U.S. proton beam accelerator facilities in operation in the U.S., and this is sort of the poster child for this. So this is a high fixed cost investment. It's $100 million to put in place, low marginal cost to operate. Evidence is that it's not any better than conventional treatments for a lot of therapies, particularly prostate cancer. It's probably good for some ocular cancer.
cancers and some brain cancers for young children. But once you get these things up, payment for treating prostate cancer using this technology is better than conventional technology, and the lure for running people through this is quite large. And so there are good ways to make money. And I think this is one example, but there's always this constant pressure. And if you think about where we were 50 years ago with healthcare, somebody with heart disease, the prognosis was not good. Right now, we can do a lot of wonderful things for them. We can have new devices, new stents, new things like that. A lot of those really do improve the quality of life, and we're better off for them, but they add pennies or dollars onto the premium. This is going to be a constant pressure pushing the cost of healthcare up, regardless of what you do. There's always going to be innovations that come out, and the challenge is to really sort out which of those are beneficial and which of those are not really adding value to the system. Oops, that's backwards. So what about utilization? So utilization is how much care we're using. Surprisingly, it's not a lot worse than other developed countries, and this is, I think, kind of unusual. We expect that the U.S. has all of these MRI machines and lots of physicians and lots of office visits. We don't do a lot worse than other countries. We're sort of at the median compared to a lot of those things. Nonetheless, we do have this fee-for-service payment system here, and you've probably heard that this creates perverse incentives. Really, the incentives are to do more intensive things and not necessarily to be outcome oriented. A kind of a dramatic version of that. This is a report that was in the Seattle Times 2 weeks ago, and so this is views of charges for top physicians in our neighboring state of Washington, and this is showing you data, and charges here is not payments, so it's a little bit of a proxy for utilization. And this is what happened when a large healthcare system took over a hospital. I think this is the Swedish Neuroscience Institute, and they're in the pink, and you can see that in 2010, the top charges going to physicians were on the left. On the right, there was a huge increase, and so these were new physicians or existing physicians that were brought in and really had pressure put on them to do a lot more surgeries, a lot more intensive surgeries, no better outcomes. In fact, some challenges there to quality. So that happened 2 weeks ago, and then just last week, those data were enough to create some desire for further investigation as to what's going on. But I think the point here is that the fee-for-service system can be abused. It really does promote a lot of intensive care and a lot of utilization, not always good. Another focus on utilization has been these looking at measures that people call low-value care. And so the notion here is that there's good evidence on some things that we don't need to do intensive care for patients. And so the classic is patients with first-time low back pain don't necessarily need an MRI or don't necessarily need opioids. And so we did a study in our center looking at Oregon, and what we found is that these patterns exist to a certain extent in Oregon. But what was most interesting is not so much the dollar amount, but really that they confirm different practice patterns. And so if you are a Medicaid patient who happens to be in the same region as a commercial patient where you're more likely to get an MRI for first-time low back pain, sorry, let me restate that, it almost doesn't matter what payer type you have, but where you are. And so if you're in a certain region where physicians are more likely to give an MRI for low back pain, you're more likely to get that whether you're Medicaid or commercial. And so it's not really the payer type that's driving that type of care, but really the practice patterns across the region. So now let me switch to price. Price is really the main driver when we're talking about spending in the commercial population. There's relatively low correlation between price and or spending around Medicare and commercial patients in regions. Utilization is similar, but the big difference is not so much that the big difference is really variation in price across commercial patients. You're going to see some really interesting data from QCOR, I believe, coming up. They've done a really great job describing what's happening in Oregon. I'm not going to say anything about that, but there's some new data from something called the Healthcare Cost Institute that's grabbed commercial data around the country and tried to provide some information on variation in spending around the U.S. So I'm going to quickly run through a few slides here. And so they have data on lots of different bundles and treatments, but I just sort of cherry-picked a few. So here's one on a sort of a standard primary care visit for moderate complexity. Dark blue is the most expensive relative to the national average. Light blue is the least expensive, and gray means there's no data. So Oregon is at the top here. here's a sort of a childbirth, vaginal delivery, newborn care. This is a really common procedure or DRG in hospitals. So Oregon's not at the very top, but pretty close to the top here. Same with ED visits, not at the very top, but close to the top. Here's one time of MRI or one type of MRI visit. So Oregon's at the top here. So a lot pointing to things that make Oregon's prices look expensive relative to the rest of the country. If you don't like that, that might give you might raise your blood pressure. But unfortunately, that's expensive to treat too. And then I guess depending on how you feel about this, that might give you heartburn. But the problem is that that's expensive to treat. So why are prices high?
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I have to stop.
He's got heartburn. Right.
Yeah, he does. You know, you said those are commercial prices,
correct?
So in an industry that is well known to have a lot of cost shifting, isn't it a little disingenuous not to look at the whole package of reimbursement, which in Oregon we're one of the lowest in the entire nation for Medicare, so that there has to be some cost shifting to other payers? So I wish you'd clarify that, please.
Yes, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller. I think I'll say two things about cost shifting. So I think the evidence on cost shifting in terms of if you pay a hospital a lower Medicare rate or a lower Medicaid rate, then do they pay a higher commercial rate? Is there good evidence for that? I think economists have come out and sort of firmly said that they don't see that. And so there's not a lot of good empirical evidence for that. I think, you know, the corollary for that would be, you know, I think the slides that you saw before was a lot of uncompensated care going away. And I don't think that there's evidence that commercial rates have come down for that. Where I do think that there is some evidence for cost shifting perhaps is a little bit more subtle, and that's looking at coverage rates, not so much payment rates, but what it looks like, this is pretty recent evidence, is if you compare states that have expanded Medicaid compared to those that don't, and pair counties that are adjacent to each other in states, it looks like the states that expanded Medicaid on the exchange market, that their payment rates are lower. So it looks like Medicaid is coming in and picking up something around some of the high-cost patients that allows commercial insurance rates to be a little bit lower. So I think that that suggests that there is some play there that may not be picked up in the sort of the ongoing studies around hospital cost shifting. I think there is something that happens there, but it's not, it doesn't appear to be a direct one-for-one exchange.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. So why are prices high? So I think one thing to consider here is the rather unique market that we have in Oregon between insurers and providers. And let's sort of walk through this theoretically on what this might look like. So there's market power on both sides, on the insurer. The insurer is bargaining with employers and with providers, and on the providers. And so providers are bargaining with insurers. You could imagine a hypothetical case of a single insurer, monopolistic insurer, and providers without any market power who are sort of out there spread out, that the insurer might be able to sort of pick and choose which providers they want and negotiate very low prices. In contrast, you could imagine a market where there are many, 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 many insurers and maybe a large group a large amount of consolidation among providers where providers had market power. In this case, insurers wouldn't have a lot of opportunity to negotiate low prices from the providers. So with that framework in mind, what do we see in Oregon? On the provider market, I think we have seen a proliferation of integration. So this has been some vertical integration where hospitals are partnering with physician groups to form a single purchasing agency, or horizontal integration, which is providers coming together in larger systems to negotiate together. That's pretty common across the country. But I think Oregon is unusual in its insurance market. And so we know that there are, I believe, six domestic insurers and a fair amount of other groups offering insurance. And so looking at data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, they sort of break these up into different group markets. But in terms of the large insurance market, Oregon's in the top decile of competitiveness. So that means that it's got more insurers than 90% of its the rest of the states. First in the small group insurance market, so the largest number of insurers offering policy, and 15th in the individual insurance market. So it may be that some of these prices here could be a result of strong market power on the provider side and relatively weak market power on the insurer side. That's pure speculation. So we did see those data on statewide things. I guess I also want to note that there's variation within the state. These are data put together by the OHA based on some, they provided the data, and then Peter Graven from our center mapped this out. And this is just an unweighted sort of variation in hospital procedures looking geographically. Dark means that prices are generally higher for procedures on average, and lighter pink means that they're generally lower on the state average. And this just goes to show, I think, that there is a lot of variation across hospitals. This also masks a lot of variation across procedures. And so if you were to look into one hospital, you'd find some procedures that are low and some that are high. So there's really a lot of heterogeneity. It's not that one state and one hospital is charging high prices for everything. So what are a couple policy options? So I think I'll start out in terms of things that I think there's not a lot of strength for, and that's around things.
Could you go back to the last slide? There's no key, so I don't.
Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. So what are you showing us?
Okay,
what I'm metro area, because there is a lot of there's not a lot of price variation, or it's competitive and versus other areas. I mean, like, is the black dot good or bad?
Yeah. So black dot is generally higher, and so the OHA has put together a payment report for a variety of procedures happening in hospitals, and so these are rolled up. These are not weighted by patient volume or anything like that. So there's a lot of caveats here, but generally, what you see is, so for example, is black dots or darker dots are going to be higher prices for most procedures. And lighter pink are going to be lower than the state average for the majority of its procedures.
Thanks.
Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So a few policy options. So I think I'll start by saying that some that I don't see a lot of evidence for are ones that focus on shopping. And so these could come in the forms of health savings account or reference pricing for procedures. I think that there is really good evidence that health savings accounts can slow spending, and that's mostly through reductions in utilization. But a growing number of studies suggest that patients just aren't very good at shopping. The same issue for reference pricing. Reference pricing is an interesting thing that's been used by the PEB version of the California version of PEB, CalPERS, and the idea here is that you pick a sort of a median price or a low price for a certain procedure, say a knee surgery, $30,000, and say that our plan is not going to cover cost above $30,000. And what you find that does is that really brings prices down to $30,000. No hospital is going to charge more than that to that plan because they know that patients can't pay for a lot more than that. But on aggregate, it looks like that may not be a sort of a strong way of addressing cost across the total cost of care. It might affect a few procedures and a few things like that, but it might not be so good for a variety of reasons of dealing with cost across the total cost of care, which is what we really care about. So what can we think about? Well, I think across the nation, there's a lot of attention to provider market power and consolidation. I think that should be monitored closely. I think payment reform should be supported. So what are we seeing coming out of the evidence around ACOs and commercial types of ACOs is generally that they look pretty good. They're not a panacea, but they're sort of moderate improvements in spending and in quality. They seem to be moving away from the fee-for-service model in a way that looks like a good start. It looks beneficial. I think that there may be benefits from good network design. So I think that narrow networks are often controversial, but in the past they've been ways of slowing spending and getting lower prices, so they should be considered carefully. And then I will put in a plug for the All-Payer All-Claims database and targets and hope here. So we've got a 3.4% benchmark that the CCOs are looking at and that PEB is looking at. That's an ambitious benchmark, but at least it's a number, and it's something to compare other groups to. I don't think we have done much as a state or as a research center to look at how utilization and spending looks relative to that benchmark outside of the CCOs. But I think we can use those data. They're there, and we can use them to answer that. I think it would help us understand if there's significant overuse. I don't expect to see things like the Seattle Times uncovered, although one of those physicians had been practicing in Oregon for a while, so it's not impossible. We don't know. We just haven't done any investigation of that. I think it would be really helpful to know if the spending increases are driven by certain disease groups. So we know about some of the issues around Hep C, but if we were to look at this, where would we see big increases in spending? Would it come from cancer or cardiovascular care or preventive care? Some of those might be good. It might be good to spend more on preventive care. Looking at some data from Medicare, looks like there's a little bit of a slowdown in the spending for cardiovascular care because of substitutions from the inpatient to outpatient setting. We have those data in Oregon. We just haven't looked at them.
John, hold on a second. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. A lot of analysis here, but I do have a question. Have you done or has anybody done any analysis if we went back in time to the original design of the CCOs that would have PEB and OEB members actually receiving care through a CCO, what the cost variance would that to be to the state?
Representative Green, like Representative Hayden, I'm not. Is the question?
PEB and OEB have the same 3.4% limitation that CCOs have.
But if they were actually provided service through a CCO or that type of model, then the commercial model, would that make any difference to the cost to the state? My question is, have you done any analysis?
There are some members receiving care through some CCOs. Yeah. I haven't seen an analysis of that.
Right. So Representative Green, like Representative Hayden, I'm not aware of any analysis, and we haven't done anything of that nature.
Representative Nose?
My question, this is very interesting. Thank you. I'm curious, have you ever looked at anything around hospitals and what's, you know, like if we were to, for example, let me try it another way. Have you done... Maryland has a different way that it does its hospital financing. Have you ever looked at that by any chance?
Representative Greenwick, Representative Nose, I am aware of the Maryland. They have sort of a hospital global budget. I'm aware of that. I think the early observations of that were promising, but I haven't seen anything more rigorous, so I can't speak to that at this point. Okay, so I think I'm done. I'll finish here. I think there are opportunities here to understand where spending trends are coming from, and then a question about accountability. And so I think that Oregon, I think I'm becoming, maybe everybody here is convinced, but as I talk to others in other states, Oregon really has done a nice job in a lot of ways with its health reform. It has a unique way of talking to providers, and I don't think we need to necessarily adopt some of the things that other states have done to put pressure on spending. But it would be interesting to understand what does accountability look like in Oregon and how does Oregon address accountability in terms of spending that's going up that's maybe not in the PEB or CCO market. Stop.
Thank you very much. Any final questions? Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
I understand it's early in the morning for an economist. Let's see. Our next... discussion we're going to have, the Q-Corp folks. Takes me back to academia, so good way to spend a Friday morning. You ready?
I am.
Go for it.
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here today. We appreciate the invitation. Today we'll be sharing a little bit about what we've learned. Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Meredith Roberts Tomasi. I'm a senior program director with the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation, or QCOR for short. And I thank the previous speaker for giving us a plug before we even came up here. So today we'll be talking a little bit about what we've learned about the costs in the Oregon's commercial market. So it will be a little different focus than what we heard from OHA this morning. We're going to try to be brief to allow for plenty of questions. For those of you who are not familiar with QCOR, we are an independent nonprofit organization founded in 2000. Our mission is to improve the quality and affordability of healthcare for all Oregonians. And we do that primarily by working with all stakeholders around the table. In our experience, we found that this yields the best solutions when everyone has a voice and can talk in a neutral environment. Since 2008, health plans have been voluntarily giving QCOR data, claims data. Today, we'll be focusing on commercial. So in the commercial market, we currently have 80% of the fully insured market, which includes most of PEB and OEB. We have 35% of the self-insured commercial market.
You don't have to be that close to the mic.
Thank you.
You're pretty sensitive.
Thanks.
There you go.
35% of the self-insured commercial market, 100% of Medicaid, and 92% of Medicare data. So this allows us to follow most Oregonians throughout time. We have patient-level historical data, which means we can track patients between private and public insurers and between health plans over the years. In the past, QCOR has focused primarily on quality measures. However, in 2013, we expanded our measures to include cost for the first time. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement to initiate a study comparing commercial healthcare costs across regions. Oregon and QCOR were selected as one of those five regions. Since then, the work has spread to 9 additional communities, so we have a pretty good geographical representation. In Oregon, our cost work is guided by the Cost of Care Steering Committee. This is a multi-stakeholder committee made up of 19 experts in their fields, physicians, health plans, consumers, administrators, and researchers. This committee has been able to collaborate over the past 2 years to find smart solutions on how to cope with a really sensitive topic that is cost. I'm going to go into a little bit of detail regarding the basis of our work. Health Partners is an integrated health system based in Minnesota. About 20 years ago, they developed a cost of care framework. This framework allows for a standardized method to look at all costs for all care delivered to a panel of patients and compare those costs to an average. Total cost can be broken down into 2 components using this model. Resource use is the measure of frequency and intensity of services used. Price component is affected by fee schedules, referral patterns, and place of service. These measures are risk adjusted. They include payments made across all settings, including professional, inpatient, outpatient, and pharmacy. They also include all payments made by not only the health plans, but also the patients. These measures were endorsed by the National Quality Forum in 2012 for the commercial population only, and that was after rigorous testing. So once we were comfortable with these measures, the first audience we wanted to reach was primary care clinics. This summer, we delivered the second round of clinic comparison reports to 176 primary care clinics across Oregon. This reflected data from 7 commercial health plans. These reports include not only cost, but also quality and utilization information compared to the Oregon average. We are committed to always showing cost along with quality. In your packet today, I think you have a sample clinic level report for your reference, so you can see what clinics are actually receiving. Now I'm going to hand it over to Doug to talk a little bit more about what we've learned and the benchmark report.
Thank you, Meredith. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Doug Rupp. I'm a senior healthcare analyst at QCOR. So as Meredith said, we'd like to share some of what this preliminary cost work is showing us. The QCOR Cost of Care Steering Committee asked us to look at the relationship between cost and quality. So we took the primary care clinics for which we were able to report cost and used the total cost index and to compare to a composite quality index that QCorp developed. And the results are shown on this scatter plot, which each of these dots representing a clinic. If cost and quality were highly related, we'd expect to see these clinics line up in a line. That's not what we're seeing, though. We're finding that clinics are spread across the chart. And if you look on the right side of the chart, where the clinics are higher in cost, there's variation in quality. Some are high quality, others are low quality. High cost does not correlate with high quality in the data that we're looking at. And that's been shown in other studies as well. The section of the chart that's most interesting is the upper left quadrant, and this is where the high quality, low cost clinics are. Ideally, we move all clinics in this direction. We also looked at where clinics are located around the state, and overall, clinics in more rural parts of the state show higher cost and lower quality as an attributed patient base. But there's substantial variation within the regions, as I think Dr. McConnell's slide showed. And we do see lower cost in rural areas as well. So I'd also like to discuss a national
benchmark.
Can we
go back there for a moment?
Sure.
It looks to me like a greater proportion of the high-cost clinics are low-quality, while a greater proportion of the low-cost clinics are high-quality.
Is that
a true generalization?
When we do a correlation on this, there is a slight reverse correlation in the data that we have, but it's very slight.
You can improve the quality by reducing the payments to them, huh?
I don't know if I would go to.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I also want to talk about the benchmark report. As Meredith mentioned, we are part of a national effort. And in January, we released a national benchmark report showing cost variation among five regions, including Oregon. And compared to the other four regions in the study, the data in our database shows Oregon appears to have higher costs than three of the other regions and lower costs than one, Minnesota. And then breaking down those total costs into the two components that Meredith mentioned, the utilization component and the price component, Oregon shows lower than average utilization, but is higher on the price component.
Question?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Going back to the comment on the previous slide where it says, on average, that rural clinics show a higher cost and lower quality, how do you calculate into that? I'm assuming, but correct me if I'm wrong, that this is kind of on a per member for per procedure. How do you account for the cost of just having a critical access clinic available in rural Oregon that might not have 1,000 people access that, but they've got to provide a procedure for 100 people rather than 100,000 people? I mean, clearly the critical access piece of that is going to cost you more to have that equipment. So how do you calculate that into this?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Hayden, that is a factor that shows up as a cost in our analysis, but it does not. It's not mitigated or assumed away in any way. And I think when we look at the benchmark information with other states, that may be something that is reflective in Oregon's higher prices overall, that we have a more rural population. And there are reasons for higher cost.
It would be a little unfair to when you have a significant fixed cost to provide procedures that we require that these folks provide, and you don't have the patient base to spread that out over geographically, how can you equate those?
What we're illustrating here is the variation, and we're not taking into account whether there is a reason that a good reason for that variation.
Yeah, but it kind of gives a black eye to the rural clinics that are working really hard that have to serve 10 or 15 or 20 people with the same procedure that you've got hundreds or thousands in the metro areas to do with the same fixed cost.
I think that we as a state need to look at and understand why certain regions have higher costs.
I don't think there's any question about it. Yeah. Well, rural areas have higher costs.
They're going to have higher
costs. It's not fair or unfair. It's just the reality of what is.
You said light is fair.
No, I mean, it doesn't relate to fair. It relates to the fact that the reality of what you said is right. That you,
it so it should be reflected here somewhere with an asterisk or a note or whatever.
You can put a gold star on the rural clinic so they'll feel better.
Thank you. I'll take it.
Please go ahead.
So the national report also drilled down on the services, the service categories of inpatient, outpatient, professional.
I have a question.
Sure.
The point you made before is that we tend to be lower in utilization and higher in price per unit. Wouldn't it be true that if the way we reduce utilization is by taking the people who really don't need the service out of the mix? Wouldn't that make the intensity of the mix different and therefore possibly cause that? I know in hospital price per day, that's really true. If you don't put people in the hospital who don't need to be in the hospital, you'll raise the average price per day because you have people there who need the services that they're getting. How does that fit into the general statement that in comparing among the regions, we're lower utilization but higher price per unit? The units are different, aren't they?
Chair Greenlick, I think you have hit on a point that we will come up with later in the slides.
Okay.
And that is that oftentimes lower utilization regions do have higher prices, show us higher prices. There is a correlation there. And just what you described is probably a contributing factor.
I'm sorry, go on. I didn't mean to jump the gun.
Nope. I just wanted to mention that we did drill down on the different service categories as well. And Oregon is showing lower utilization in these categories. As far as price goes, except for pharmacy, it's the medical side, prices are shown as higher, with inpatient being, in the data that we're looking at, 27% higher.
Inpatient, 20% higher per.
This is the average of the five regions.
Per stay, per day, per person?
Total costs, and we're looking at basically costs spread across the population.
Cost per person.
Across the commercial population.
Great.
So, Chairman Greenlick, I think this gets a little bit to the thoughts that you had. Reflects a little bit on what Dr. McConnell mentioned. There have been a number of factors that lead to higher costs overall that have been identified. And if we break them into the two areas, price and utilization, they sort of break out this way. We've seen that in states that have lower utilization, prices can be higher, as you mentioned, Chair Greenlick. And it's also possible that cost shifting may be happening between private and public payers. I certainly am not going to contradict Dr. McConnell, but and we don't have any evidence directly of this, but there's. But Oregon does have lower reimbursement rates on Medicare than the other regions. And negotiated rates, as Dr. McConnell mentioned, are also.
So you just said something that challenges what I thought I understood.
Oh.
I thought Medicare reimbursement rates were set at the federal level and Medicaid was set at the state level. Is that not correct?
Yes.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, they are set. Medicare rates are set at the federal level. But reimbursement rates in Oregon are lower than they are.
The feds set it differently state by state.
Yes. State by state and hospital by hospital, region by region. There are different rates.
Thank you for that clarification.
So, again, the negotiated rates between provider and hospital can play a role here. Areas with limited competition may have higher prices. And then, additionally, when we look at the nation as a whole, the overall cost of living can be a factor as well.
It's actually my fault that organized.
So, going forward with the cost of care work, QCorp will be participating in this national benchmark report for future rounds, and we anticipate adding more regions. We're hoping there will be 8 regions in the next view of the data. We'll also be looking at year-over-year trend variation and trying to understand what the drivers are in cost at the clinic level. We'll be releasing additional rounds of the clinic comparison reports that Meredith mentioned on the commercial population. Additionally, we will be releasing those reports for the Medicare fee-for-service population. And QCorp has been rewarded a community technical resource contract to help other communities across the country with this work.
I heard the summary bottom line was that our prices are 17% higher than the average. Is that a correct summary of
Chairman Greenlick, that is what the resource use is lower and that prices are higher than these other regions. And I think it's also important in, from our work is the variation of cost and quality across the state and how cost and quality are not necessarily correlated.
Further questions to this? It's very interesting work. We'll be back talking to you, I'm sure, as we move forward.
So quick question, just so I know whether to follow up with you. Are you also disaggregating the behavioral health costs across the state?
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, we are looking at behavioral health costs.
Great. I'll be in touch. Thank you.
Okay.
These two first.
Oh, there's one more.
Thank you very much.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. So in your analysis, you're just looking at commercial rates?
Correct.
Yeah. I think that's not a very rigorous approach when, you know, government payers are the biggest payer in the state of Oregon.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Bueller, we completely agree. The reason we started with the commercial population is that what was endorsed by the National Quality Forum. So it seemed the safest way to introduce this measure to the community. Over the next year, we will be producing similar levels of information for the Medicare fee-for-service population, and we are actively investigating whether we can do the same thing for the Medicaid population. So those are all on our list of to-dos.
Have and OED are included in your commercial rates?
That's correct. Most of PEB and all of OEP.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to hear now from COHO. Who are we starting with?
Phil Greenhill and Tracy Muday.
And then?
Then on deck will be Will Brake, Josh Ballack, and Jennifer Johnston.
Okay.
Representative Greenwich and members of the committee, my name is Phil Greenhill. I'm a CEO for Western Oregon Advanced Health, and with me today is Dr. Tracy Muday. She's our chief medical officer. So I'll start by saying in the last few minutes, everything I've learned through business school and accounting has just been blurred like the snow in Coos Bay today. So if you would allow me, I'd like to just bring some
clarity. Ask for a refund on that tuition.
It's been too long. I'd like to clarify just a couple of things. Representing Newsweek, we have no public employees at Bay Area Hospital. We do have a lot of SEIU members, but and in turn of Bay Area Hospital, if you look at the map that showed the dark places that were high cost, you'll notice a lot of those dark places with hospitals especially were in the rural parts of the state. The federal government has seen fit, given the recruitment issues that exist in hospitals in rural areas, to subsidize an enhanced DRG payment. That drives the prices up across all provider lines. That's principally done because nurses are extremely difficult to recruit to certain parts of our state, so that DRG is lifted as a reimbursement incentive for recruitment of healthcare professionals, which drives you to a dark spot on the map. That's one indicator of costs. Looking at some other things, Representative Hayden, you asked about PEB and OEB. I'll go out on the line. We could probably bring the cost down 30% right off the bat in a managed care program. Be a lot of unhappy people, but it could be done. So, and that's 40 years in this business of looking in the crystal ball. I want to take you through reserves just a minute, because we talked about a 5% factor up there. But first, looking at a hospital's balance sheet, it's different than any other industry you'll go in. You sell a product for $10,000. The insurance company pays you $8,000. You take a $2,000 contractual adjustment. We've allowed that fairy dust to be called community benefit. Okay, you go down to the Chevrolet dealer, you buy a $30,000 car, you pay $25,000 for it. You don't get $5,000 of community benefit for that Chevrolet dealer. Okay, it is a contractual discount. I've been a hospital CEO for 20 years, before 20 years in the managed care business. That's how that works. You don't really find it in any other industry. Okay, it's different to that hospital accounting. Then you work down to your expenses and your profitability on the bottom line. Looking at CCOs for just a minute, let's take a real 101.
I'd like to comment on that point. I think you're right. You go down to the Chevy dealer and they got a $35,000 price tag on there that nobody's going to pay. I get it for $28,000. You get it for $26,000. He gets it for $25,000.
Right on. He's a good trader.
Those aren't losses. Those are just different.
They don't sell it below cost. And now you may get a real good deal at one point in the country, because it's like the wine business. You have 10,000 cases of wine. You sell 9,000 cases. You cover your costs. You've got your profit margin. The rest of it's bottom line profit. So there are some things there.
Okay.
Representative Mueller.
Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. But the difference in that situation is that somebody can set the price at $25,000. It's not a negotiated price between the federal government and the hospitals. It's set by the federal government.
They're volume buyers. And the same thing would happen to that Chevy dealer. The Chevy dealer, if I come in and say I'm going to buy 45 cars from you next year, you're going to give me a different price than if you buy one car.
You can't refuse the price. That you're a price taker as a hospital from the federal government. You can't refuse.
Of course you can refuse it.
What's that?
My point is that in any sales operation, you have a great number of different of different prices, and your total volume is made up of the sum of those prices.
Right. I totally agree, but there's one person who just tells you what you're going to sell that car to them without any negotiation. You have to take their price. If it was a negotiation, you could refuse it. That would be different, but you have to take that price.
In a DRG hospital situation, you're 100% correct. Your profitability there comes in your ability to perform under that fixed case rate.
In some of the hospitals, it's, for example, the one I'm most familiar with, St. Charles, 75% of their customers are Medicaid or Medicare.
That's why they've been losing so much money.
They have not been losing
money. He's kidding.
Baloney.
Okay,
we have Representative Kenny Geyer.
Okay, just a quick question. Are you not for profit?
Our organization is a C Corp organization. We are a for-profit corporation. Our CCO is an LLC standing alone with equity investors.
Thank you.
Okay. Looking at the CCOs and looking
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I just wanted to weigh in a little bit, and I think maybe it's more to the point on the car dealership. If I pay $28,000 for it and Rob pays $25,000, good on him. He just saved $3,000. But how does that $3,000 help all the rest of us that paid, you know, the fact that he saved $3,000, how does that help the rest of the community? How do we consider that a community benefit?
Because he's such a nice guy.
Rob doesn't come and help me. So the point is that community benefit?
It does keep the institution in business, regardless, as long as they have sold that product and delivered that service above their cost, then they do still continue to exist as a viable entity.
And he also, maybe he can't get it for $25,000, but he says, I'll charge you $3,000, but I'll drive you to work every day.
I'll take you up on that. Come pick me up.
But, I mean, there is some of that, in a sense.
But going back to some basic...
I'm sorry, this has gone from the sublime to the
ridiculous. Well,
why don't you get back on track here?
Stay in the weeds.
Going back to looking at some of the reserves in the CCOs, we are required, undoubtedly, as Mark spoke to a while ago, to have a 5% reserve. In the early days of establishing CCOs, there was a lot of discussion about moving to a DCBS standard. That's where you're hearing. And many of us have moved forward to have additional reserves over and above the solvency reserves required by OHA. I refer to a lot of those reserves as flexible reserves, meaning that we can use them in many ways within inside our structure and our organization. For example, some of them are used to secure the equity position of the people that capitalize the CCOs. The only money we got from the state to stand up these CCOs was later on in some small transitional transformation grants. Okay,
you can sell them to Centene. You can sell them to Centene.
Yeah, we could. We could, but I don't think we have any intention of doing that. But when you look at our 5% reserve area, too, you also look at other things that are on our balance sheet that's not really readily known. We carry another reserve with inside those reserves we have on our books called IBNR, incurred but not realized cost. That is a triangulation of our claims payment. If we were shut down today, can we go out 24 months and have all of that reserved? We carry between $12 and $15 million at any time on our balance book, on our balance sheet, to pay for those. Okay, and those are part of our reserves. All right. So, and then there's flexible reserves that allow us to do innovative programming. Barry Hospital last year, from the fact that their bad debt was lower, put out a $1 million challenge grant in our community. Our physicians on the CCO side, the delegated entity of the IPA, matched that $1 million challenge grant to build a new science and technology building at Swalk Junior College. And the reason is we can only graduate about 8 nurses at a time right now. The labs are 50 years old. We need to look at that workforce. That's part of the long-term trend that we're looking at about how do we put enough workers, healthcare workers, in the community to supply the demand. It's not there right now. So I think Dr. Madej is going to talk a little bit about a couple of examples that are impacting our cost trends. Don't mention cars.
No cars. So I'm Tracy Mudé. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Western Oregon Advanced Health and a family physician by background. So if we want to talk a little bit about cost drivers in healthcare and specifically in Medicaid, certainly I appreciated Dr. Rickard's testimony regarding pharmacy and pharmacy spending, the high-cost drugs that are helpful, or we think they might be helpful, but we have no good way to control, how quickly those prices rise. Another example of costs that may not play out exactly the way you think. We recently had a baby with a hypoplastic heart, left heart. This is a severe heart defect. Was transferred to a tertiary care center outside of the state for a potential transplant. We managed to get them to agree, Seattle Children's Hospital to agree to a cap of $2.5 million, and that's just for the initial expenditure. So while we carry stop-loss insurance, and that will limit the amount that we pay up front, what will likely happen if we pay this out is our stop-loss insurance may double next year, and that goes into administrative costs, not medical spend. So when we are looking at our expenditures on a year-by-year basis, we lose some of those high-cost individual cases that good management can't prevent that baby from ending up in the hospital. So,
and one other thing on that, we'll pay that stop-loss point up to $200,000. Past $200,000, we'll pay 10% of the remaining $2.25 million. Okay? So that's going to be a baseline of $450,000. Insurance undoubtedly will double because I had a hard time holding it down in this rate negotiation. That's going to be another $400,000.
The total population you're covering.
Yeah, that's a 700. I'm sorry?
What's your total population?
20,000.
Roughly. Small population.
Small population.
Wow. Makes that variation a problem.
Well, we reserve for that. And you know, it. In this business, one day you're going to be the bug. One day you're going to be the windshield. And you reserve for the days that you are the bug. I mean, we've seen the cyclic changes in our ACA population. The last 2 years, it would look like this. So OHA looks at it, drops its 5%. This year, the costs are going just like that. Okay, and we're seeing that in measurement of our stop loss. We report everything that's at a 50% point, meaning anybody approaching a potential $100,000 spend, we put a flag on it and say, let's watch this case. And this year we're seeing a greater climb than we've seen in the last 5 years. And I think you'll find that trend pretty true across the CCOs. It takes at least a minimum of 5 years to know a population, and we're just now starting to know this ACA population from a risk point.
Yeah. Well, we need to move on to. Go ahead.
Oh, I just want, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if you all are getting together and trying to determine why that would be all of a sudden in the fifth year. I mean, for you, I can understand how it might be just a few cases would blow that out because you have such a small
population. Well, ACA only came on about 3 years ago, so you've got a maturity of that population you've got to look at, and we're talking specifically about the ACA population.
Right.
We don't necessarily see that in the trend of our older population. We've been managing that group for like 20 years.
Right. Okay. Can we call your colleagues up now?
You don't want to talk anymore about cars?
I'd love to talk about cars.
Okay. So I think the complexity that we have, too, in cost drivers, though, is to look that our CCOs are prepared to actually, you know, just not win the battle, but win the war. And that means that you've got to look at risk over time. And I think sometimes when we're trying to come up with rate judgments and everything year by year, we're missing the point of what has got to be a minimum of 3 to 5 year trend.
Well, and I still have a problem with the rate calculations now because they are not pure risk adjustment. They go back and look at things in the past, which they should not be doing. That's a special battle I have with OHA on this one.
Well, maybe we'll talk offline too, because I'm sure.
Dr. Woodet had one more.
So if I could just just 1 or 2 minutes, and a little bit in that vein, one of the things that we were asked to speak to is spending based on our community health improvement plans. And this is something where multiple organizations around the community have put together a plan to try and reduce actually the burden of disease in our community. So, you know, those health outcomes. What we are seeing there is that the spending that needs to be done to help promote some of those goals is not necessarily traditional medical spending. It's things like making sure the community college can produce enough nurses and CNAs and EMTs. And very much like the quality incentive measures that we've worked on, what we see is there's kind of an S-curve of development that we have slow incremental progress at first as we're learning how to put these programs in place. And then once we start to get the hang of it, the improvement happens a lot more quickly. So those gains, those investments that we're trying to make in the overall health of the community, they drive practice patterns for all payers, not just for Medicaid. And they take a while to really come to fruition and maturity. So if we're looking for that return this year or next year, we're really being a little bit short-sighted about what we may see in 10 years.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming a long way as you did.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have a couple more folks from the CCOs, and then we have a closing statement from the Hospital Association who wants to set all this stuff straight. Yeah, we will remind them. They'll have a whole meeting to talk on Wednesday. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Johnston. I'm the Health Strategy Officer at Primary Health. We're the smallest CCO in Oregon, and I'm a registered nurse by background. And I want to take a little bit different direction on looking at some of the cost drivers in healthcare and in CCOs and talk about what we've learned about adverse childhood experiences and the implications of childhood trauma on ongoing costs in the medical system. When we've been working with our high utilizers, those members often have chronic diseases, substance abuse disorders. They have other risk factors, homelessness, and they also oftentimes have untreated mental health conditions. And we have noticed as well that we have a very strong thread when we have developed stronger relationships with these members through community health worker initiatives, that they have a very deep thread of childhood trauma throughout that population. So I want to talk about the ACEs study just for a moment. So the ACEs study was done initially about 20 years ago with a middle-class Kaiser population, a commercially insured population, and they screened this big group of beneficiaries for 10 different childhood trauma kind of events. So examples would be substance abuse by a parent, homelessness, domestic violence. And what they found was that childhood trauma was very common. That was the first thing. And they also found, when they looked at the medical conditions, a dose-related correlation between childhood traumatic events and the likelihood of developing chronic diseases, substance abuse disorder, of not graduating high school, of being unemployed later on in life. And why this is being considered probably or even called the greatest public health discovery even of all time is that theoretically, if you could reduce the incidence of childhood trauma, like not actually eliminate, but just reduce, you could also reduce as a sweeping motion, the incidence of all of these chronic diseases over a population. And why I think this is important to CCOs and the CCO model is the CCOs are looking more upstream at ways to prevent childhood trauma with some of our global budget activities. So an example of that for Primary Health is that we've created a $1 million community investment fund to help further transformation of healthcare. And some of those investments have focused on things like working with the schools to implement the CLEAR program. So the CLEAR program is working with a national expert in ACEs science to help teachers learn about ACEs science and use it in their day-to-day teaching techniques and in their school policies to help promote a better learning environment for kids that's more likely to help them succeed in school. Another example would be trying to promote things like a sobering center. We've helped to fund opening and operating a youth homeless shelter in our county. So looking at the ways we can fund upstream investments in healthcare and outside of healthcare that will help stabilize this population. And I think that's one of the reasons I think the CCO model 15 years down the road, if it keeps progressing in this way, will really start to overshadow some of those programs in other states that maybe are showing some similar outcomes right now, because we're really working on the deeper structures outside of healthcare that impact our overall outcomes.
You have a question?
Yep.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
I'm sorry.
I have a quick question. So I'm very unfamiliar with ACEs, and I'm
interested in learning if you all considered working with our education programs, our institutions that teach educators.
Yes.
Is that something that you guys are going to be doing?
Yes. So Representative Greenlick, Representative Alonzo Leon, we are. So the CLEAR program is working with one of our school districts. So they're rolling that out to one elementary school this year with plans to spread that to three more elementary schools in the same district next year and potentially looking at grant funding to get that out to the entire district over the next few years. So I think this definitely involves partnerships with our education sector. And another example would be helping to promote early learning activities such as kindergarten preparedness activities.
Follow-up, Chair. I understand that's happening. I'm referring to training educators when they want to be teachers, like Western Oregon University. They have a teaching program. I'm curious to know if you guys are considering being part of the curriculum and preparing teachers as they want to be educators. Does that make sense?
Yes, I understand your question. So I don't know if that's happening, but I hope so. Okay. And I think the same thing in the medical community. I don't know to what extent nursing schools and medical schools are incorporating the science into their curriculum, but I hope it's happening. I think that is very important.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
Committee, I'd like to go 15 minutes over today, if that's all right with you.
That's fine.
Maybe you can say.
Chair Greenlick, if I might, this is Josh Balick, Vice President of All Care Health. We actually serve in the same area with primary care of Josephine County and Jackson Care Connect, and we've actually been working with SOU. Former Representative Peter Buckley has been one of the leaders in how actually helping try to teach teachers these types of things, but we really have been working with the college. In fact, just found out last night, we're actually going to start working with people who work with incarcerated children to really start to adapt these types of things. So it's not just the medical, it's not just teachers, it's really spreading throughout the entire region. And I believe in consultation with you guys, we're actually going to be having the ACES training for the entire school district inside of Three Rivers, which is basically the donut outside of Grants Pass in Josephine County. And as far as we know, we think this is the first in the nation to do this. So there's a lot of very exciting things happening around this, and a lot of credit goes to Southern Oregon, WOE, Jackson Care Connect, Primary Care of Josephine County. We've really all embraced this and really said this is the way to get upstream to change health outcomes, not 3 years down the road, but 30 years down the road.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Josh, you have something else to talk about? No, seriously?
Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I had the pleasure of coming down there and seeing All Care in action, and I was very impressed with some of the things that you did, and particularly, you know, incorporating ACES, and that wasn't, you know, something that I expected to see, and some of the progressive ideas, and I took back and talked to other people about that. But one thing I wanted to comment, in nursing schools, I know I've been a preceptor for different nursing schools, and they are incorporating that in some of the programs I know at OHSU and Linfield that have come through there. It wasn't something I learned about eons ago in nursing school, but it is part of the curriculum, I'm happy to say.
Okay, where are we?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Will Brake. I am the Director of Provider Network Transformation Services for All Care Health. I'm also the Vice Chair for the OHA Scoring and Metrics Committee. We all learn at a very young age about rewards for behavior. As a child, I often was told that if I finish my dinner, I get my dessert. As we grow older, we learn that if we do a chore or a job, we get a reward. It turns out a lot of the same behaviors work in healthcare. Throughout the development of our APMs, or our alternative payment models within All Care, which we have seven of, we have proven that these incentives really do change behavior. We incentivize providers. We have seven different alternative payment models, and that when we add these incentives in the right place, that we improve health and we reduce cost. Our programs incentives focus on chronic disease, prevention, childhood development, and behavioral health. Some of our results are a true testament of how this is not only improves health, but reduces both short-term and long-term health care costs. Some of our results include a 64% increase in adolescent well care visits for children 12 to 21, a 13% decrease in emergency room visits. With some of the lowest visits in the state, we feel that incentivizing physicians to care for the patients in the appropriate setting has greatly assisted in reducing this number. We've had a 23% increase in prenatal care. With this measure, we have surpassed 90% achievement. While the majority of these women are on some sort of substance, which includes tobacco. If you would have asked us years ago about achieving 90% or 95% in some CCO cases, which I believe you've achieved, with prenatal care in a population that sometimes they don't have a phone number, they don't have an address, and they're on some sort of substance, it's pretty amazing that we've been able to achieve those types of numbers. We've had a 23% increase in dental sealants, and a 203% increase in developmental screening for children within their first 3 years of life. We've also had a 42% increase in colorectal cancer screening. As a result of the colorectal cancer screening, an average of 30% have either had a polyp or cancer diagnosed. I personally went to my primary care doctor last year, and he said he pulled up his chart in his computer. And he said, oh, because of All Care, all of our patients now, I personally have Regents Blue Cross, all of our patients have a reminder that when you're over 50, you're going to have a colonoscopy. So it's your turn to have a colonoscopy. So I went and had a colonoscopy.
Certainly a wrong recommendation.
Yes. And turned out I had tumors. So I had surgery the following month. Luckily, they were precancerous. For me personally, it hit home very quickly that what we're doing at All Care had an impact on what my provider is doing with all of his patients, not just the All Care patients. But it comes up now, and it's starting to have that ripple effect across commercial insurance, Medicare, not just Medicaid.
I hope that's not All Care's recommendation for everybody over 50. There's much more efficient screening models than that.
Obviously, there's much more in-depth criteria. But in my case, I had no prior history or no symptoms, so it was simply I was 55 years old and had not had one yet. So in addition to my role, I mentioned that I am the vice chair of the OHA Scoring and Metrics Committee. For those of you who don't know, we're responsible for the development and management of the measures that all CCOs are responsible for achieving. Currently, there are 17 measures that incentivize the providers across the entire state. One of the committee's primary tenets is to make sure that every measure is transformational. We are not just looking for check boxes or things to count. Will these measures truly improve the health and well-being of Oregonians while reducing cost? As the bar continues to rise on these measures, like I mentioned, we're in the 90s on several of these measures. We're now in the 90s as far as expectations. Let me back up here. A lot of this has become a true stretch goal for some of our CCOs. Now, that first year we all kind of hit the low-hanging fruit. It was quite simple to achieve in comparison to where we are today. Today, to have the bar raised three times in these 3 years, as an example, somebody getting a colonoscopy, those first few years we were able to remind people and they went and got them. We're in the third year of folks, and it's the resistant folks. It's the providers who aren't as engaged, and it's the patients who don't, we can call them, we can send postcards to them, we can remind them, we can have those pop-up screens, but they're much more, the group that's much more resistant now. And so these measures are becoming much more difficult to achieve the levels that we'd really like to and need to. You know, 4 years ago, if you would have asked us if, as a state, we would reduce ED utilization below national benchmarks, we would have likely thought it impossible.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
I'm actually done. So.
Good. Josh, do you have something to say?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, Vice President of Government Relations and Health Policy for All Care Health. It's nice to see you guys. It's nice to be back up here for a little bit. But, you know, it was really funny. I was 14 hours ago, I was actually in a meeting with the Early Learning Hubs, or excuse me, it was an All Care Health event that I think the other CCOs sponsored with the other early learning hubs and local business leaders to see if we could start to coordinate early learning with business community to be able to recruit people and retain people in our families. And it was down in Medford. And I just remember thinking, I really wish Doc was here to see this. It was this great moment of Senator Bates, of three different businesses all kind of coming together, really looking at the whole person to be able to deliver healthcare. And that is what we're able to do. So I guess when I saw this and I was like, okay, what are the cost drivers? I think the number one cost driver is going back to the old system. That's what scares me. That's what we need to be protecting, what we've built here. It is remarkable. And the upstream impacts are going to be even better. Just a quick little thing about where we've been at. In Josephine County and Curry County, there was 13% uninsured rate there. Right now, it's below zero, or below 1%. It's basically operating at zero. That's remarkable. And then if you kind of factor in the place where there are higher uninsured rates, medical bankruptcy still is higher up there. It's still the number one cause. Just think about the economic impact of not having bankruptcies to a rural community. I would make an argument this committee probably has more impact on what happens in rural communities than as much as any other, because healthcare has become such an economic driver in the rural communities. Top to bottom. But then that's just our economy. But then when you really look at the cost savings that we've already been able to generate the state, it's really remarkable. Already we've saved, just by holding down at that 3.4% number, we've saved the general fund $250 million. We're expected to save the general fund $600 million this next biennium. We've already saved the federal government $2 billion, and we're expected to save them another $2 billion just this next biennium. We have been saving money, and we have been delivering quality. I mean, the really cool thing was, if you tallied up all of those metrics that we were doing it statewide, we improved as a state on every single measure. How cool is that? And if we have a problem where we're going back into the old system, if we start to fall back into that way, that is not good for anyone. We've really become a remarkable case study that the nation really is looking at. Other states do look around and they go, how is Oregon doing this? And I would say it's 20 years of the Oregon Health Plan, a lot of really committed people, and I think moving down to Southern Oregon, being in the Rogue Valley, and seeing those rural communities really kind of rally together and just say, let's just make this work, we're going to figure it out, has really resulted in major cost savings.
Safe to say your population doesn't want to do away with Obamacare on the way to making this country great again.
I think keeping the ACA insured would be a very good idea. Yes.
Thank you. Is there any other questions, this panel?
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. This would ideally be a question, but I'm sure you don't have the answer for it, so it's more of a comment. Maybe a question for the future. I love the upstream. I love what you're doing. I know that you've seen addiction rates go down. You're attaching it to the smoking. So, you know, particularly prenatal care, early childhood, behavioral health in the schools, school nurses, the degree to which CCOs can operate more and more and help in that space, because sometimes we don't have funding streams from other places. The one area going even greater upstream that I'm really hoping hospitals and CCOs will get more into is housing. So you have community needs assessments that you have to do. Housing has come up more and more as one of the top three for almost every area of the state. And you're sitting on assets that you are investing in something. And so I'm curious about the degree to which you're investing in affordable housing, and of course the for-profit entities can write some of that off if they take a lower rate of return toward charity care in mission-related investing. And nonprofits maybe don't have that, but you have the nonprofit mission. So I really am encouraging, since you have a certain per member per month that you have to deal with, and the greater we can have that pool, the more you have flexible funds that way. But you're also sitting on a tremendous amount of assets. And I'm hoping that that your boards are looking at how can you use some of those assets to build affordable housing, because we know that is a source of toxic stress. We don't have enough in this state, and the toxic stress that's caused from the pregnant woman creates inflammation to the child for a lifelong learning disabilities, chronic disease, et cetera, as well as for anyone who's outside the womb and is also experiencing that toxic stress or mold in the house. So the other thing that I'm curious about is investing in market rate housing with speculation and the degree to which that may be happening right now and causing more harm in our community. So I hope that your boards are really looking at how you're investing those reserve funds. Thank you.
So, Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer, we have actually very much been looking at that. In fact, we've worked together with Primary Care to open up the only youth teen housing area in the county. We lost it. We actually helped reopen it. A group called Hearts with a Mission helped recruit them in. It was a really great step. There really are three levels inside of it, the way we look at it. There's crisis, transitional, and then long-term. In Josephine County, we have a 0% vacancy rate. So we are very keenly aware, and we have actually committed time, energy, effort. We've been in meetings together looking at Josephine County, Jackson County, and Curry County. I mean, it's the whole southern Oregon area. So, yes, we are very much looking at that. There are some federal regulations that kind of make it hard for us. We can't just pay for housing. But there are a lot of ways that we're getting very creative to be able to pull other sides. And we're taking that real can-do attitude of bringing the community together to find solutions in that you find in Southern Oregon. We're really applying that to the housing crisis in our community.
Guys, thank you very much for coming. Mr. Comer, can we have a brief statement from you, please?
It's dangerous. You're running over and we're on a Friday. Thank you for having me.
You're the only thing standing between us and the gym.
I know, this is a problem. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. For those of you who don't know us, we represent all the acute care hospitals in the state, not only the DRGs that you saw about earlier today, but a lot of the rural hospitals, and there's about 32 of them statewide. So a couple of comments and appreciate a longer conversation down the road. I was actually thinking about this, Chair Green, like this is probably my 10th anniversary of presenting in front of you, and the first time I did was presenting a lot of that data for the health authority and having an almost two-hour conversation about the system and the whole system and all its component parts and thinking about how we use data to drive policy conversation. So I look forward to that kind of less narrow conversation than we had today about how the system works, how all the parts work together, and how we move it forward. We're continue to be committed to transformation. I think we've shown that over the last couple of years, and we continue to do that. We look forward to the partnership with this committee and others about how not only we continue the work, but how we invest in the work of transformation moving forward. I know all of you know the challenges that face us, and it's really about us coming together and figuring out how to solve those problems together. I really want to sort of advocate here for a real honest conversation on community benefit. Our members commit almost $2 billion annually in community benefit. And we had a pretty limited, high-level conversation today that I don't think did justice what our members commit to. Housing, as an example, representative. There was a fairly significant housing investment in the Portland metropolitan area from our members. And we sort of breezed through it and didn't do it, I think, the justice it deserves. And then I think lastly, what we would want to commit to you all to is making sure that we're having a conversation where providers are at the table. So we're not just looking at it from one view. And I obviously only speak for us, but there's a whole lot of other providers in the system that you didn't hear from today. So with that, Chair Greenlake, I'd be happy to answer any questions and not get in front of your break. Thank you.
And we will be talking about community benefit, I think, next week.
Wednesday.
So we'll have more discussion about this. Is there any questions?
Everybody's tired.
Sean, thank you very
much. Hey, thank you.
No further business before us. We are adjourned. Thank you for staying a little late. For the business before us. We are adjourned.